I'm Sarah Walton in New York.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Yeah, thanks, Rebecca Foster. Welcome to Wednesday's Richie Allen Radio Show. Another dull and, well, there's no summer, is there? It's pretty rotten. It's Wednesday. It is the 8th of July, 2020. Your Richie Allen Show.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, the government has said that schools will be back in September and every student will be in the classroom. And head teachers will have the powers to fine parents who don't send their children to school. There is a campaign group called Us For Them, which is getting a lot of attention. And I'll be speaking to Christine Brett, the co-founder of Us For Them. They want schools to open without delay, and they do not want children subjected to social distancing because they say it's contrary to the children's human rights. So I'm looking forward to catching up with Christine on the programme this hour. And in the second hour then, glad to welcome back to the programme the university lecturer and author David Sedgwick, whose recent book, The Fake News Factory, Tales from BBC Land, is an outstanding read. I want to talk to David about lots of things. We'll go through the gamut of the big stories of this week with David and more. He's also got a very interesting article that was published this week as well. So that's what's happening. Welcome to the programme. Tweet me as usual if you'd like to do so. Listen, before I go anywhere, I want to reach out to MCR Flooring. MCR Flooring. And I want to say thank you so much for supporting the radio programme in the way that you did. And I'd like you to reach out to me, please, by emailing me through the PayPal email address for the programme or send an email through the website. That's MCR Flooring, because I want to phone you and have a chat with you. So thank you very much. I did try to contact you through your website yesterday and today, but I don't think it's possible. So please do that if you don't mind. And thanks again. Well, I know it's very tabloidy and it doesn't really belong on the Richie Allen Radio Show, but I'm having lots of laughs following the Johnny Depp case, the libel case, with the Sun newspaper. I really am. And I'm laughing, and we laugh, you and me, about stuff. And we laugh about things that some people get offended by. I don't condone violence, no matter who's responsible for it. It doesn't matter whether it's inside a house, outside a house. Doesn't matter whether it's state violence. I don't condone it as a means of resolving anything. It's dreadful. But you can't not laugh at some of the stuff that's being heard in Johnny Depp's case against the Sun newspaper. He's basically been saying, Johnny, that Amber Heard beat the granny out of him regularly, that she cheated on him and humiliated him with their friends. But then she shit in their marital bed, and well, that was the end of it for Johnny.
What kind of fuckery is this?
Oh, the stuff emerging from the libel case. And as a journalist with experience of libel in terms of, I've got to know what libel is, I'm finding it fantastic. Trial of the century. He's suing the Sun, and I don't know if he's going to be successful. They called him a wife beater. It's been it's emerged that he has a tattoo that says Wino Forever, but it used to say Winona Forever because he was with Winona Ryder, and apparently Amber took the royal piss out of the tattoo and Johnny threw punches. It seems to be the most toxic relationship ever. Both of them piss heads and total junkies.
The junkies bastards, yeah. The junkies bastards, yeah.
Junkies that just teed off on each other while drunk as skunks. Violence is wrong no matter who does it. Kanye West announced earlier this week that he was thinking very strongly of running for president. Well, he said he was going to do it. Now he's going to give himself 30 days to consider it. And he's been doing interviews with Forbes magazine, and vaccines came up. In the interview, Kanye said he would model his White House operation on Wakanda. Now, I'm so sick, the BBG, because you get to refer to yourself in the third person, only twice a year. And this is my second time. the BBG, I thought Wakanda was somewhere near Rwanda. But it turns out that Wakanda is a fictional kingdom from the film Black Panther, which is a good film, right? Decent superhero movie. So he said he would model his White House on Wakanda. He also told Forbes magazine he's extremely cautious about a coronavirus vaccine. He was sat next even to his campaign manager in the making. And Kanye said, they want to put chips inside of us. They want to do all kinds of things to make it where we can't cross the gates of heaven. And the reporter be like,
You fellas been doing a bit of boozing, have you? Sucking back on grandpa's old cough medicine?
Hey, Kanye, there are some legitimate concerns around vaccine safety. Please stay off our side. Those of us that are asking questions about vaccines. So he hasn't made his mind up anyway, Jesus. Talked yesterday about Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, who said that he was going to take the lead and have unconscious bias training. Remember this, he was on LBC with Nick Ferrari, and a woman called Sharon rang in, a black lady, and she said, are you going to have unconscious bias training, Keir, there? And Keir said, yeah, all of us are, in the Parliamentary Labour Party. And he was asked by Nick Ferrari, how long will it last? And he said, about 3 hours. Well, apparently he was lying through his teeth, because the Times newspaper has learned that he was he's telling pork pies about 3 hours. He's actually introduced a compulsory course on unconscious bias for Labour MPs and peers. And wait for it, it lasts for 20 minutes. Right. Snowflakes be like, right? Unconscious bias. We've all got unconscious bias, allegedly. 20-minute course on unconscious bias. And, well, your mind is free then. And you'll never again then be prejudiced against people of colour. You heard in the news there with Rebecca Foster, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, will cut VAT on hospitality as part of a £30 billion plan to prevent mass unemployment as the economy is hit by the deadly coronavirus. The government will pay firms a £1,000 bonus for every staff member who is kept on for 3 months after the furlough scheme ends in October. Sunak announced the scheme to give 50% off to people dining out in August. That's dining out in August only on Monday, Tuesdays and Wednesdays. He said hardship lies ahead, but nobody will be left without hope, said Rishi Sunak. Here he is today in the Commons.
People need to know that although hardship lies ahead, no one will be left without hope. So today we act with a plan for jobs. Our plan has a clear goal: to protect, support, and create jobs. It will give businesses the confidence to retain and hire, to create jobs in every part of our country, to give young people a better start, to give people everywhere the opportunity of a fresh start. Where problems emerge, we will confront them. Where support is justified, we will provide it. Where challenges arise, we will overcome them. We entered this crisis unencumbered by dogma, and we continue in this spirit, driven always by the simple desire to do what is right. World economic activity has slowed, with the IMF expecting the deepest global recession since records began. Household consumption, the biggest component of our economy, has fallen steeply. Businesses have stopped trading and stopped hiring. Taken together, in just 2 months, our economy contracted by 25%, the same amount it grew in the previous 18 years. And the Independent Office for Budget Responsibility and Bank of England are both projecting significant job losses, the most urgent challenge we now face. I want every person in this House and in the country to know that I will never accept unemployment as an unavoidable outcome.
Yeah. Now, do you want to hear a summing up of what he's doing? Because Colin Brazier, Sky News presenter in the afternoons, don't you know, sums up some of the things that will be offered as part of the 30 bill. Here's Colin Brazier.
Well, let's take a look at the details, or some of the details, of Rishi Sunak's headline measures. The Chancellor's announced a £1,000 bonus per employee who returns from furlough. Businesses will also receive £1,000 for every trainee offered a work experience placement. Rishi Sunak also announced a £2 billion emergency package of support to help prevent youth unemployment by subsidising 6 months long work placements of 25 hours a week at the minimum wage for those aged between 16 and 24. VAT on food, accommodation and attractions will be cut too, from 20% to 5% from the 15th of July until the 12th of January. The aim is to protect 2.4 million jobs, the Chancellor said, while everyone in the UK will be eligible to take advantage of an eat-out to help-out discount of up to £10 per person in participating restaurants from Monday to Wednesday during the month of August. Terms and conditions apply. The Chancellor has also temporarily raised the stamp duty threshold, where it applies in England and Northern Ireland, from £125,000 to £500,000, meaning that most people buying a house won't have to pay any tax on the purchase. That applies, of course, in England and Northern Ireland, not Scotland and Wales.
Right, we'll leave it there. OK. We know. Magic money trees and all of that. All of this borrowing is ultimately going to be borne on our shoulders. And I'm not going to repeat that again. This magic money tree where Sunak goes to the Bank of England. The Bank of England basically prints money out of nothing. Loans money into existence. And then says you've got to pay it back with interest. You know how it goes, so I won't bore you with it. In the Times this morning, there was a very interesting article, which I tweeted, headlined "Face Masks as crucial as hand washing and distancing." Right? Not wearing a face mask should be seen as antisocial, says a top scientist. Right? This is a guy called Venki Ramakrishnan. Venki Ramakrishnan. I had to practice that about 64 and a half times this afternoon not to mess it up, lest I be accused of, well, unconscious bias. So he heads the Royal Society and he has a Nobel Prize in Chemistry. And he made these comments as a report was released showing that despite the growing evidence that masks slow the virus transmission, the UK is among the worst in terms of people wearing them. He went on to say the UK is way behind in terms of wearing masks and clear policies and guidelines about mask wearing for the public. What else did he say? The public have taken to hand washing and distancing, but remain sceptical about face coverings. You need only go on public transport, where they are supposed to be mandatory, to see how many people are ignoring this new rule, based on the growing body of evidence that wearing a mask will help protect others. This guy Ramakrishnan said that, as in other countries, this meant it was now time to normalise the use of masks. And then, incredibly, he said, it used to be quite normal to have quite a few drinks and drive home. And it also used to be normal to drive without seat belts. Today, both of those would be considered antisocial, and not wearing face coverings in public should be regarded in the same way. Wow, right? Now, what's fascinating about this is that the UK's morning talk shows, and they are legion, Radio 5, Radio 4, LBC, Talk Radio, and the television ones with the Ginger Ninja and Piers Morgan. All of them carried this story, and all of them, I mean all of the presenters, spent a good deal of time urging their audience to take this seriously and start wearing the masks. Listen to Julia Hartley Brewer talk with David Navarro, who's a special envoy on COVID to the World Health Organization. She's a talk radio presenter. This is, for me, this is staggering. For you, you might not think much of it. Listen to Brewer and listen to what he says to her, the doctor from the World Health Organization.
I really noticed in doing my show the last few weeks is so much has been about, you know, coming out of the lockdown, recovery, the economic side of things, rather than dealing with, I think there was a period for 3 months, we just must have, every other guest must have been a medical guest talking about developments there. We now know a lot more about this virus, but a lot of us are sort of, I think, viewing it as sort of, well, that was something that was horrible that happened, and now we're trying to get on with our real lives. But as you say, we're not over it, and all the experts are saying we're at the beginning of this, not even the middle, and certainly not the end. But the new ONS, Office for National Statistics survey data, where they actually just go out and randomly select people to take the coronavirus test, as opposed to people who are coming forward with symptoms themselves.
Now, I've never heard a presenter waffle as badly as that since my days in Spain. This is what is she building up to here exactly? Well, she gets there in the end.
They found yesterday in their latest report only 22% of people testing positive for coronavirus had any symptoms at all on the day of the test. They may have gone on later to develop them or not develop them at all. As we know, most people don't.
And this, she's rambling on, and she's getting to where she says that just because you test negative for the virus or you are asymptomatic doesn't mean that you won't get it. You're still a potential spreader of the virus. And therefore, well, masks.
And this is the real worry, is that actually, you know, the people who say, well, I don't need to wear a mask because I haven't got the virus. Well, we have no way of knowing whether people do or don't have the virus, which is why everybody needs to wear the mask all the time.
Wow, everybody needs to wear the mask all the time, says Julia Hartley Brewer, allegedly a conservative talk show host. Everybody needs to wear the mask all the time. And, well, what does David Navarro say when she says that?
The virus, which is why everybody needs to wear the mask all the time.
I mean, you are the most brilliant communicator, and I love the way in which you can just capsule these things, say them straight.
What the feck is this now?
And I wish you were on every single radio station around the world nonstop, because it matters that everybody gets the point, that this is not a joke. It is not just something done to try to cause trouble to people. It is a deadly serious, horrible virus. Did you know that?
So the media is the propaganda wing of the World Health Organization and people like Bill Gates. Right? You heard Brewer there. Everybody has to wear a mask. This guy says, as if she's a trained seal, well done you, you're marvellous, you're brilliant, I wish you were on every single radio station. That was this morning. Shortly after that, Kay Burley is at it as well. Because the World Health Organization also said this morning that there is growing evidence that COVID can be passed on by tiny particles in the air. Now, this is horse manure. They're making it up as they go along. So Burley, incredibly, she's got a doctor on called David Lloyd. He's a regular guest. He's an elderly doctor, right? And Burley starts going into a list of things that allegedly COVID can do to victims, starting with the brain. Remember, she's with Dr. David Lloyd. Here's Burley, the ginger ninja.
Temporary brain dysfunctions, we're learning more about now.
Temporary brain dysfunctions.
Yes, I think the increasingly the interest is on COVID being a condition that affects the blood vessels of the body rather than the lungs. And so areas of the body which have got lots and lots of blood vessels, the brain, the kidneys, are the areas where you can get problems with COVID as well as the lungs. And so, yes, we're seeing a lot of problems with the brain as well as with the lungs.
So those sort of symptoms, we literally don't know what we're presenting with, I'm guessing, when you ring the doctor and you say, oh, you know, but I'm a bit dizzy, but obviously that's not COVID. It could potentially be.
This is garbage now. This is rock bottom for a presenter, for a journalist to be carrying on like this. Rather than challenge any of this and say, where's the evidence to support you having a bit of a sore throat, or you having a bit of fatigue, or being a bit dizzy, or whatever. Where's the evidence to support the notion that it might be COVID? Burley is helping him along. This is crap.
Well, yes, I think that's right. I think the more we look, the more we find these COVID syndromes.
COVID syndromes.
The tiredness, the headaches, the confusion.
Tiredness, headaches, confusion, dizziness. All of those things might be COVID now. And COVID now can transmit through the air outside in microscopic particles, apparently.
Very long-term illnesses that make them feel very vaguely unwell for a very long time. And if you track it back, they've got the antibodies and they clearly had the illness sometime in the last few months. So, yes, we still don't understand the full extent of this extraordinary disease.
Extraordinary disease. Not a disease, it's a virus.
And I'm afraid that we are all very worried about the second surge, and there just aren't
the second surge, eh?
People out there wearing masks. So if I could just make a quick plug.
I want to make a quick plug now for wearing masks. So basically the media, the World Health Organization and the government and the sage scientists have come together and said, right, on Wednesday, the 8th of July, it's full-scale propaganda to convince the public that now is the time to make mask wearing outside the home mandatory. It is going to be made mandatory to wear a mask outside. It really is. I'm not making it up. Listen to this guy, yeah, wind it up here.
Wear your mask.
That's what I was going to ask you about, whether, you know, suggestions are that it's a bit like not wearing your seatbelt when you're driving your car. If you go out, you should put a mask on. Is that, do you feel as strongly as that?
Absolutely. I wouldn't. When I wander around the supermarket with my mask on and I look at all the others without their masks, I'm thinking, you know, think of all those droplets. Think of all that virus that could be spread so easily. So please wear your mask when you can, or wear clothing so that you can cover your face.
Okay. It's good to talk to you, Doctor. As always, I can see you've had your lockdown haircut done as well. It's good to hopefully...
Burley is worthless, isn't she? Hey, people aren't wearing them in supermarkets. Young people aren't wearing them. Why aren't young people wearing the masks?
Enjoy yourself and kill a granny is the answer.
Is the answer. Welcome to the Richie Allen Radio Show for Wednesday, the 8th of July. That's it. 2020, right? Christine Brett joins me in a couple of minutes. Don't miss that. We'll be speaking about Us For Them, the campaign. Yeah, that's music from John Parr on the Richie Allen Radio Show. 26 and a half minutes past the hour. Drive time, although it doesn't feel like drive time anymore, not these days anyway. This was in the Times newspaper this morning, and it's a poll that shows that one quarter of parents do not intend to send their children back to school in September, even though they could be fined. The Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has repeated the return to school would be mandatory for all year groups and that head teachers will be able to penalise those who keep their children at home. It was a survey of 13,500 parents and it found that 26% did not intend to send their children back to school. Of these, 80% believed that the government was reopening schools for economic reasons, 67% felt that it was unsafe, and 63% said they did not care if they were fined. Now, we're joined this hour by Christine Brett, the co-founder of a campaign called Us For Them. They're campaigning to demand that the government reopens all schools without delay. They reckon school closures are inconsistent with the rights of a child to an education and that social distancing for children is contrary to their human rights. And I'm delighted to be joined by Christine Brett, who's in Cambridge, I believe. Hey, Christine, welcome to the programme.
Hi, Richie. Good to be here.
Nice to hear from you. When you see that in the Times today, Christine, that a quarter of parents might be reluctant to send their children back to school at all in the new school year, what do you think of that?
Well, I think we have to ask ourselves why they're reluctant to send them back. And I know from our supporters, the people who've been following our campaign, that the message is that they don't want to send their children back because they don't like some of the measures that schools are implementing around social distancing. They don't like their children being lined up in the playground behind chalk marks. They don't want their children to be sat apart, you know, at tables 2 metres apart. They don't want their children not to be able to play the usual activities like football, you know, that they usually do at school. And because of, you know, the way that the government's gone with the social distancing, I'm afraid these measures are set to stay unless we can stand up and say, no, we don't want this for our children.
I understood that there'd been some change in the government's thinking around social distancing in classrooms. And it's a bit muddy, this, isn't it? Because depending on where you look, you read that when they go back in September, the children will be subjected to social distancing and separation in the playgrounds. But then I've come across tweets, I've come across bits and pieces from MPs who say that, in fact, it won't be, that they're just going to scrap that whole idea altogether. Where is the government, Christine, as far as you understand, on the measures intended for schools in September?
Well, unfortunately, the distancing and these bubbles that we talk about are still a key feature of the new guidance. So even though they've made the bubbles bigger, so for primary school, that means that they'll be in a bubble with their whole class rather than half their class, they're still very much there. And let's just take a moment to think about what that means for children. It means that they can't mix with other children in their year if there's more than one class, or, you know, it, from other years. So when children, you know, play together and do activities that are across different years, that won't be able to happen. And we feel that the government needs to be much more prescriptive about this, because the problem that we've got at the moment is that schools are interpreting this guidance, you know, with varying degrees of severity. So some schools are saying it's fine within a bubble, children can play normally together, whereas other schools are still making children socially distance within the bubbles. And it's just not clear. And I think schools have got a very difficult job, because the government hasn't given them a clear direction to say, actually, there's no evidence that social distancing works for children. It's all the evidence points in is that it's very harmful for children. And we're essentially telling them off for doing things that are normal behaviour, like hugging their friends, like playing with their friends. And we're kind of conditioning them to stay apart from everybody. And this is very damaging for them.
Talk to me more about that, Christine, this idea that it'll have a profound effect. There's no point in me trying to be the devil's advocate here, because I agree with you. I think it's crazy. But for our listeners, and there will be people listening to this, and they might have children, and they might be worried from the other point of view. You know, they might be worried that schools are not safe. I don't think they're right, but look, that's their opinion. Talk to us about the evidence that says subjecting children to these measures is going to be harmful to their emotional well-being.
Well, I mean, I think intuitively we know when we look at those pictures of children sat in a chalk circle in a playground, we know that something, you know, is wrong with that. And, you know, that's just as humans and as parents. But we've had a body of experts come out now, experts in child health, experts in clinical psychology, paediatricians, all saying this is very, very damaging, because physical distancing is contrary to what you want children to do. Children learn through play, and play means interacting with people. It means, you know, whispering a secret. It means passing a note. And making those things forbidden is actually very damaging to children in the long term, because it will prevent them from forming, you know, more stable relationships. We know this is a very mild disease in children. We know that COVID, you know, happily doesn't affect children in the same way that other viruses do, like flu. We know, you know, there's only been 2,000 cases in the whole of the UK in children recorded. So we know that it's not everywhere in children. And we know from all the studies that have been coming out of countries that have already gone back to school, and some of them that have never closed their schools, we know that children aren't transmitting this to teachers or to adults. So I think, you know, I know it's a very scary time for people, and people are afraid because they've been told, you know, stay in your houses, don't come out. But we really do have a lot more information now that's out there in the scientific community to say that actually children aren't transmitting this condition. They're not going to come home and pass it on to a vulnerable person. And I understand that a lot of people are afraid about that. But, you know, vulnerable people need to be protected from other things as well. And that needs to be taken into consideration. But we shouldn't do that by putting the whole burden of this onto children's shoulders. They need to get back to school to learn. They need to get back to school to play with their friends. And the current guidance means that there'll be no assemblies, there'll be no nativity plays, there'll be no football matches, there'll be no sports days. That's quite a miserable prospect. I think we can all look back on our childhood and remember, you know, the fun things about school. And actually, with this guidance, children aren't going to have that. And it's very worrying that there seems to be sort of no end to it either. You know, the community levels of the virus now are very, very low. So, you know, we think about there being one case in 2,200 people in the community. You know, that's not even, you know, a single case in five secondary schools or 5 or 10 primary schools. So the chances of children getting this are very, very low. And I think the damage that's being done now from isolating them from their friends and stopping them playing normally is causing a lot more harm.
When the government says, OK, the risk to children themselves is certainly a lot less than we initially thought, but we still remain concerned that children can be carriers of it and can, I mean, this is what they're saying effectively, and can transmit it to vulnerable people. Hence, this is why we're asking them to distance at school. What do you say to that?
Well, children distancing from each other isn't going to stop somebody else getting in the household. And we actually know that the child to adult transmission is very uncommon. the Royal College of Paediatricians, who are the leading doctors for children's health in this country, they say the transmission is very minimal. And we know from the 22 countries that have gone back from around the world to school that there hasn't been a single case reported of transmission from a child to a teacher. So I think if children were going to be spreading this virus, we would see it now very clearly in the numbers. And we're just not seeing that in any of the other countries that have gone back, or even in countries like Sweden that have never closed schools, where they haven't done social distancing, when children have been playing together normally and in interacting with their teacher. We haven't seen cases being transmitted from children to adults.
Christina, I don't know if you've moved away from the microphone slightly. I just lost you towards the end there. You tailed away there. It's been a little bit in and out. No, that happens. So if the government, the government will know what you've just explained to us, that, you know, there aren't any examples really of children passing it on to parents, that children are really not a risk to others. Why then do you think they're persisting with the plans to roll out this, I agree with you, pretty grim existence for children in schools in September. Why do you think they're adhering to it, despite knowing that the evidence points to them not needing to do it?
I don't know. It's very confusing. You know, we've had 1,500 paediatricians write to them. We've had 150 child psychology experts write to them. We've had 300 NHS doctors that have begged them to give our children back their childhood. And I don't understand why they're not listening to the experts. You know, as parents, we're saying to them, we don't want our children to be treated like they've done something wrong. Because remember, when we sit somebody on their own normally at school, that's because they've done something naughty. We sit them apart from somebody. And that's that behaviour that we're conditioning into them through doing these methods is going to be very harmful and very damaging.
Christine, Brett is our guest. There's huge interest in this, enormous interest in it. Let me ask you this. There are those... I'm 45 now and I remember primary school. And from what I understand, primary schools are vastly different places now than they were when I went to St. Saviour's National School in Ballybeg in Waterford City in Ireland. And it seems that there was more license for children, not just to play, but to be inventive and to be, I don't know, expressive, than there is maybe in the year 2020. And some people have said to me, including one or two teachers that are in contact with the programme, they reckon that the last few months for, I don't know how many children, but for some children, might have been a very liberating thing in terms of getting to learn at their own pace, getting to learn as they choose, being more expressive, being more creative. When you hear that, Christine, what do you think?
I think, you know, some children have had probably a very nice time in this period, and that's great. But I think we have to remember that that's not the experience for all children.
Yeah.
You know, we know that 94% of vulnerable children haven't returned to school. We're hearing terrible stories of children, you know, who are in abusive families, who have suffered, you know, because they haven't been, you know, having a nice time and having a creative time. So I think we have to think about that. I mean, that's 2 million vulnerable children we're talking about out there. So I think we have to take some responsibility for that. And I think we also have to remember that this has been an incredibly stressful time, you know, for parents who are working, trying to juggle managing schoolwork with doing their own jobs from home, which isn't normal for most of them. So, you know, we've all been cooped up together, you know, even where children have had a nice time, I think there's been pressures there that will come out. And the fact that they've all had quite a different experience is going to be challenging, I think, when they get back to school. And I think the worst thing we can do is then sit them all apart and not let them engage and just recover from this experience and get back to normal. Because children will, you know, relish the opportunity to see their friends and to see their teachers and to get back to some kind of structure and format that they need, really, to give them that security. I think what's so frightening for children at the moment is the adults don't seem to have a clue what's going on. And that's a very scary prospect for them.
Yeah, it must have been pretty difficult for parents trying to work from home, as they were told to do when this began, and also manage their children. Christine, I want to ask you, Simon Dolan, the businessman, failed in his attempt to get leave to take the government to court over the lockdown. I was a supporter of what Simon was trying to do, and I noticed that in the judge's opinion or decision, he alleged that there wasn't really much disruption to education, something along those lines, I believe. And I know that your group, Us For Them, and by the way, the website is usforthem.co.uk, your group is pretty annoyed by that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really worrying when, you know, the government's argument was, A, that they didn't close schools because schools had remained open for some of the children, the key workers. But we know that even now, with reception year one and year six back, only 10% of children are actually back at physical school. And I think the other disappointing thing is this idea that education is just supplying information to pupils online or, you know, via work packs. We know that actually 71% of state educated children haven't had any online lessons or have had less than one a week. So I think what we're devaluing teachers and their role in terms of engaging children and giving children feedback and inspiring children. If we say that education is simply delivering learning to children in whatever format. So I think really we need to ask ourselves, you know, what does education mean? Because, you know, for me, you know, I can remember teachers that really made me interested in a subject at school. And I think, you know, children will respond to that. And that will be a lifelong experience that many, many people will have. And I think we need to make sure that, you know, we give our generation of children the same opportunities, you know, for engaging and for being inspired by teachers who can do that.
Do you share my fear that the private sector has not will, but has tried to take advantage of what's been happening? I've had people on from the United States, very good writers and journalists, who've written about the corporate takeover of education. And what corporations want to do is, you explained it beautifully, the turn of phrase you used, they want to provide just learning, and they want it done on tablets, on phones, and they ultimately want it done in the home. Is that something that, it sounds like that worries you as well?
I think it does worry me. And what worries me about this new guidance is this talk of remote learning, as if that's one facet of it. And let's be clear about it. Remote learning is that it's remote. Children don't just learn from their teachers. They learn from being together with each other, doing partner work, doing group work. And I think it's very worrying that we've actually deepened the divide now in terms of the provision of education in this country. So, you know, private schools have had a much better experience. They've had Zoom lessons, they've had work marked, they've had, you know, contact from the teachers. And the other end of the spectrum where, you know, we know that, you know, 2 million children haven't done any schoolwork at all during this time. So I think we've just deepened the divide, you know, whereby we're saying that actually, you know, for some people, you know, education will be lost now. They won't ever return to school. And I think it's very worrying if we think that it can just be something that can be packaged up and delivered via the internet, because that's not education.
No, it's not. It's not. Let me ask you this before we talk about the campaign and the petition. Usforthem.co.uk. This is a question out of left field now. You don't have to get into this if you don't want to. But I hear from a lot of parents on the programme who say that they're a bit concerned about relationship sex education and how it's changing and how it's being taught. And they're a bit concerned that children are now being asked at a very young age to consider their sexuality and sex and stuff like that. And the people who are getting in touch with me, Christine, I can tell you, they're not right-wing, you know, religious zealots. They're not. They're parents saying, hang on a second, we're talking to children about things that we didn't talk to children about until they were in their teens. Just a throwaway question, is that something as a parent that concerns you? Is it something that needs to be looked at, do you think?
I think so. I think parents have a different view on this, and I think it's not something that should just be decided by the state and just delivered by the school, because I think, you know, there's very different dynamics in different families and they need to be taken account of and handled sensitively. I mean, I think in terms of the current situation, we're kind of conditioning children that touching anybody's bad, getting near to anyone's bad. So I think, you know, first and foremost, we need to address those issues before we can even start talking to them about how to have relationships with other people, because we need to make, you know, clear that it's actually okay to even hug our friends. And at the moment, that's something that's forbidden, which is very difficult for children to deal with.
My thought on that is, and I speak to a lot of my friends and some of my friends, obviously working in media over the years, some of my friends, of course, are gay and lesbian people. And we often talk and we say, you know, I'm a straight guy and I've never had any issues whatsoever with gay or lesbian people. I didn't need to be told that when I was 6 or 7 years old. I didn't need to be told that you shouldn't think this or you shouldn't think that. We figure these things out as we go along. And I just wouldn't like to be bothering or burdening children with this sort of subject matter when they're very young. Just let them figure it out themselves as they grow older. What do you think?
I think definitely. I mean, I think it's very difficult for children of that age to really, you know, understand things. And I think, you know, we have to respect that, you know, some families, you know, have different dynamics and that children grow up in a different way. But it doesn't mean that, you know, we should condition everyone to think the same way. I think we need to encourage them to look around at what's going on, to question what's going on, and to be able to speak to their parents about it and their teachers when it's appropriate.
Yeah, very good. It's funny when I think of that. One of my grandparents is very suspicious of people of colour. He's a very, very old man now. And my next door neighbour, whom died in the 1990s, he was very senior when he died, was very suspicious of people of colour. But it didn't rub off on any of the rest of us. You know, as much as we loved them, we just didn't pay attention to them. Christine Brett is on with this. Finally, Christine, because I shouldn't do this, but I endorse your campaign. You know, the idea that they go back in September and they're subject to this very draconian, tyrannical, anti-human behaviour really is wrong and can't do any good. No good can come of it. There's no medical evidence to support doing it either. Tell us, so it's usforthem.co.uk. Tell us about what you'd like our listeners to do now, having heard you today.
So we'd love you to go to the website and sign the petition, join the other, you know, thousands of supporters that have signed the petition for us, that we can take that forward. And we'd also like, you know, people to come on board and help us get the message out there by sending us evidence of what schools are doing. We know that there's a big disparity in terms of what the provision of home learning has been and also what the plans for September are. Because even though the government's saying, you know, all schools have to go back in September, we're already hearing of whole counties that are saying to schools they won't be going back in September. They'll be going back in a stage phase. We're hearing about blended learning, which means part time. It means that some parents think that they're going to go back to work, but actually they're going to have the children still 2 days a week. So we really need people to come on board and share those stories with us so we can put those forward to the government as evidence that actually what they're saying in the guidance and what's happening is quite a big gap, because there seems to be, you know, a need to have much more prescription from the government about what schools should be doing. And they need to really lead from the top now with this.
Good, good stuff. So it's usforthem.co.uk, and it's us. If you look for Us For Them on Twitter, you'll find the Twitter. I'll tweet a link out to it anyway, so that people can follow it. In the future, Christine, when the subject comes up, particularly around moving education out of the classrooms, something which I'd be, you know, watching very closely, and the corporate kind of takeover of education, I'd love to have you back. I might get a panel on that sometime, if that would be something you'd be interested in doing.
That'd be great. Thank you very much.
Well, lovely to have you on today. Thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Rich. It's been lovely.
You're
welcome.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, Christine. Boy, that's Christine Brett there. Christine is the co-founder of Us For Them. And they're demanding the children are allowed to go back to school immediately. And they want to basically to get rid of these social distancing measures and these bubbles and these playgrounds with chalk marks to separate people and telling children not to hug one another or to get too close to one another. It's a really good campaign. Usforthem.co.uk. Do check it out. Christine Brett there on Wednesday's Richie Allen Show. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. I liked her. I liked Christine. Look, I know you and I, we've got a lot of problems with education. We do, of course, in terms of what's happening in schools to begin with. I'm not dismissing that. I hear you loud and clear. And you know, we talk about it often enough. But dreadful situation what they want to do to children in September. Dreadful. Absolutely dreadful. On the whole thing about families. And this is a big thing. I was listening to, I think it was the Victoria Derbyshire. I like Victoria Derbyshire. Very good presenter. And presents on BBC Two. It goes out on the TV and the radio, weekday mornings. And she had some people on last year. We talked about it on this programme. And they were people who mooted the idea that if you know that a young child is growing up in a house and they're hearing things deemed to be racist or homophobic, that child is essentially being abused. And, you know, steps and measures need to be taken. That's a terrifying thing. Effectively, you know, mum or dad, who might otherwise be, you know, loving their child and looking after their child and feeding their child and clothing their child and playing with their child, Mum or dad might have opinions that we wouldn't agree with about LGBT folks or about people of colour or whatever. Maybe we should intervene. And I always come back to this. I grew up in Ballybeg in Waterford City in the late 1970s. And we moved to Browns Road in Lisdoggan in the mid-1980s. And two or three of the most influential people in my life, whom I loved, had opinions about black people and had opinions about same-sex couples that we would just laugh at today, or we wouldn't agree with, or we would just ignore. But I wasn't any the worse off for being exposed to their opinions, even at a young age. I didn't soak them up and agree with them, if you know what I mean. That's an interesting thing, and you're going to hear a lot more of that in the coming years. A lot more of it. You know, children, interventions in the home because a child might drop a clanger in a classroom and might say, oh, well, the blacks or the Chinese or whatever, where did you hear that? Oh, I heard my dad say it. Well, we need to call social services. We're going to be hearing some of that in the coming months and years. You have no doubt about it. This is your Richie Allen Radio Show. Lots to talk about when I come back. Don't forget, I will be joined as well very shortly by none other than David Sedgwick, the lecturer even, and author. I can't wait to talk with him.
The Richie Allen Show is live and interactive. All episodes are archived on Podomatic, Spotify, iTunes, and YouTube. For more details, go to richieallen.co.uk.
Renowned healer Mark Byerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Byerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbyerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Yes, welcome back. The Ryder Cup, some of you are sportoids. Like myself, I like a bit of sport. You know that. I like a bit of footy. I like a bit of rugby league. And occasionally a bit of a rugby union. The Ryder Cup, of course, where Europe takes on the United States over four days, Thursday to Sunday, every 2 years, has been postponed until 2021 because of coronavirus. Yes. Interesting story, we covered this the other day. The athletes, Bianca Williams and Bianca's partner, or is he her husband, Ricardo dos Santos, is that his name, the Portuguese athlete, they were stopped in London by police officers and they were forcibly dragged out of their car. And a video went viral as a result and it was pretty distressing, not very nice. Bianca Williams' child, 3-month-old son, was in the car as well. This happened in Maida Vale on Saturday. And what's very interesting about that is that the couple maintained that they were doing nothing wrong, they were minding their own business. And the police maintained that they acted appropriately. The police said they were driving erratically and on the wrong side of the road. But the police did send a copy of their own incident report to the couple, and there was no mention of the erratic driving. What's interesting about it now is Cressida Dick, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, she initially backed her officers and said nothing to see here. But today, she has apologised to Bianca Williams and Ricardo dos Santos and the 3-month-old baby boy as well. Ricardo dos Santos said, I've got a expensive car. I've done okay for myself, you know. And because I've got an expensive car and because I'm black, I've been pulled over about 17 times in the last couple of years. So that's not good. So to those who say that it doesn't go on, it does obviously go on. I never deny that, by the way. My black listeners might be saying, oh, you big baldy bollocks, there you are, you hypocrite. No, that doesn't contradict my overall opinion that the UK isn't a deeply or profoundly or systematically racist country, because I don't believe that. There's some idiots in this country. Of course there is. I've always said I believe the police is a problem. There's a problem in the police. There's a problem with the police, full stop. I told you the story, didn't I? I don't think I did tell you the story. I was coming down Liverpool Street about 5-6 weeks ago, and a couple of police officers were exiting a car and were walking to a front door. And they didn't look like police officers. They were kitted out in all black gear, like bondage gear. You know, with the armour plates on the elbows and on the forearms. Muppets. Both of them are wearing sunglasses. A man and a woman. And I've got a big gob on me. Obviously. And I couldn't resist it. I said, where do you get the balls to walk around our community looking like that? That's exactly what I said to them. And they looked at me and they looked at each other. And one of them said, just go about your business and mind your own business. And I said, I won't mind my own business. Why aren't you wearing a blue shirt and a tie? Why don't you look like a police officer? Somebody that you can approach. You look like a gangster. You look like a thug. You're walking around our neighbourhood looking like a thug. What gives you the right to do that? And in the end, they just ignored me and banged down this door. They were looking for somebody. I don't know what they were doing in the end. But they didn't look like police officers. I don't like police officers. I don't know why anybody would want to be doing a job where they get to tell other people what to do as a living. Oh, you wouldn't be long about ringing them if you needed them, Richie. No, I wouldn't be ringing them. I've never phoned a police officer. And I don't think I ever will. Yes. Good morning, good evening, good night, wherever you happen to be listening in the world. Hi to Liz Jones. Hi to Susan. David Sedgwick joining the programme in a couple of minutes' time. Hi, Gail as well. How you doing, Gail? Hi to Johnny B. How you doing, Johnny? A lot of conversation about education and how education has changed from the days we were in primary school to today, when it seems to be very, very different in terms of how it's organised. And the experience a child would have today is almost, it would be unrecognisable to the child who went to school in the late 1970s, early 1980s. Keep those tweets coming in. It's at Richie Allen Show. To see what other people are tweeting me is a very simple thing to do. Where it says search Twitter, just put Richie Allen Show, all one word, in. Press enter and you'll see what people are tweeting to me. Yes. Chris tweets to me, Richie, what was this I heard, that private school kids will be able to do the usual 9 or 10 exams, but state school children will only be able to take 5 GCSEs. I saw a story or a headline saying that very thing, Chris, yesterday, I think. I'll have to dig it out. It was one of a lot of stories that came across my desk yesterday. Diane tweets, how you doing, Diane? To be honest, Richie, kids would learn more of value if they went and worked on a farm at weekends. I did that, learned a great deal of useful skills back in the valley days, Diane, presumably. Tell you what I did when I was younger. A few times. And I loved it. I loved it. So I grew up in Ballybeg, which is a big estate in Waterford City. And the estate is built alongside the Cork Road, which is the road to Cork from Waterford. And one of the things we could do when I was 7 years old, seven now, Jesus, you couldn't imagine anybody getting away with it today. When we were seven, we would stand outside our front doors in the summer holidays, and a big rickety old bus would come along, and we would get on the bus, and the bus would drive to somewhere in Wexford, and we would pick strawberries. We would basically do picker jobs, children. And this would have been 1982, I suppose. 1983. And you got these big buckets and you walked around the farm and you put strawberries in the buckets, right? And every time your bucket was full, you took it to the weighing station and they made a mark alongside your name. And at the end of the day, you got paid in poundage or kiloage or whatever the bloody hell. And you had to pick a minimum to pay for your return bus. So you couldn't just turn up and run around the drills and basically arse around all day chasing the other kids. You had to pick a minimum of strawberries to cover your travel for the day. There's no parent in the world now would allow a 7-year-old get on a bus, right? And be taken, I don't know, 25 or 30 miles to go and pick strawberries. But I did it. I tell you what, it put hairs on my chest. It did me no harm, I tell you. Yeah. God be with the days, huh? Can you imagine the health and safety now? Can you imagine the hysteria around something happening to your child? Nobody would do it, would they? It's 6 o'clock. You are with the Richie Allen Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester. Great to have your company as always. You can tweet the programme, it's @RichieAllenShow on Twitter. I look forward to hearing from you. David Sedgwick joins the programme presently. He'll be with me in a couple of minutes. We're going to run down the big stories, and David's got an article out about the BBC, but it's more broad than that. So I want to get his thoughts on that as well. And that's going to be a lively conversation. David Sedgwick joins me, so don't miss that. Any questions, anything you want to contribute, do so via the medium of Twitter. Alrighty. Okay, I think we'll do headlines. We'll do headlines. We'll do headlines. See what's been going on in the world since we last heard from FSN. Let's do that then. Ah, Jesus wept, eh? The best laid plans and all of that. Where's me headlines? Come on. I mightn't have headlines now. I don't think I have headlines, do I? No? No? All right, no headlines. No headlines then. It's got to be music from Whitesnake. We don't have any news, but we've got music from Whitesnake, David Coverdale. Yeah, Wednesday's programme. It's pretty warm in the studio now, despite the fact it isn't warm outside. We can go over to FSN now for headlines. Headlines it is, back with more after this.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The US hit a new record on Tuesday, recording 60,000 fresh coronavirus infections. Two big US universities are suing President Trump to try and stop him from removing foreign students' visas if their courses move exclusively online. And civil rights auditors are warning that toxic speech and misinformation on Facebook could unfairly influence the US presidential election.
Yeah, thanks, Rebecca, then. Thank you. David Sedgwick in a couple of minutes. Don't miss him.
Thanks to you, The Richie Allen Show is the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. Show your support for this unique broadcaster by making a regular financial contribution. Just the price of a cup of coffee each month will make a massive difference. Visit richieallen.co.uk for details.
Now, welcome back. Hi to Mad Monk there, Mad Monk. How you doing? Richie, we cut grass in the summer or washed cars in the winter. Walked dogs, delivered papers and ran errands. We had little jobs to buy stuff as kids. Kids of today are not self-sufficient as we were. That's half the problem, he says. No values or accountability. I don't know. Every single generation in history says, oh, when I was a lad, we did this and we did that. Today's kids, well, they're not up to much. So I'm not sure, Mad Monk, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. We do, every generation does that very thing. We were great, and we were hard. And today's kids, well, they don't cut the mustard. I'm not sure. Anyway, what's going on there, eh? I tell you what, there's something going on. I don't have to key it in manually, do I? Mother of God. I should be phoning David now. David Sedgwick, but something has gone horribly wrong. I might have to input the number manually. It's programmed in. It should just ring. But it's not ringing. Oh, what are you going to do? Take some more music. Take some more music. I don't even have any more music lined up. What have I got? I'm not even sure I've got any more music lined up. Or do I have the Doobies? Have I got the Doobies? Alrighty. Music from the Doobies. And when we come back, David Sedgwick. Sorry about this. It's one of those days. We're not even having the music. It's Breakdown City here at the Richie Allen Show. Ah, there you are. There's the Doobies. I do hear the Doobies. Back in a minute. Hopefully with David Sedgwick. Yeah, the Doobie Brothers. Let's get rid of that because I want to have more time with David. Sorry about that. I don't know what happened there. There was a technical malfunction. But I'm delighted to welcome back to the programme the author and university lecturer whose most recent book is a brilliant read, The Fake News Factory, Tales from BBC Land. You got to check it out. He's written a really interesting article as well that can be read at commoncentral.co.uk to talk about that and to talk generally about the lockdown and about the attempt to take the government to the High Court and the media and all the rest of it. It's great to welcome back to the programme our friend David Sedgwick. David, welcome back. How are you?
Hi, Richie. Yeah, I'm pretty good, all things considered. And it's good to talk to you again.
It's great to talk to you. I was your ears were burning this week because I was thinking of Simon Dolan and how his bid to take the government to court over the lockdown, how it failed. He wasn't given leave to do so. And I couldn't help thinking of you and your books, of course. And the amount of time, coverage and invites by the BBC particularly, that Gina Miller was given when she took the government to court over Article 50. And there's a businessman, a prominent one, a well-known and successful one, whose case against the government is equally as serious. He couldn't get a look in, David.
Yeah, and how many people actually are aware of what happened, first of all, about what he was trying to do, which, like you say, was entirely commendable and right, and that's exactly what he should have been doing, and he should have had a lot of support for that, and I'm glad people like yourself platformed him. But, Richie, how many people actually knew what was happening, and then how many people actually know what has happened and what has transpired and how they've just basically... I mean, it was predictable what they were going to do to Mr. Dolan and, you know, dismiss him. That's the establishment. That's what we might have expected. But where's the outrage? Where's the analysis from the BBC and the mainstream media on that? You know, nothing. Silence.
It's dreadful.
It is. It's dreadful. I mean, we have a right. People have a right to know. That was a huge... the ramifications could have been massive, and it's almost as if the mainstream media decided we're not going to give this any airtime at all. We don't want to know that this is happening, and people are just in the dark, and that's not what the mainstream media should be there for. And that's, you know, why I'm always criticising institutions like the BBC, but it's not just the BBC. I don't listen to Sky or Channel 4, but I'm pretty sure they would not have covered it. No. At all. I'm sure The Guardian weren't covering it. I don't know. I mean, that puts us in a pretty darkness, doesn't it? In a really dark place when we don't know what's going on, and that someone's doing a very noble thing on behalf of us. I mean, it's on behalf of the people. And yet, I tell you what, I bet about 90% of the people don't even know what Simon Dolan was trying to do.
No, it's a sly thing. The Guardian gave it a mention, and he did get a couple of minutes with Ian King on Sky News, but that in itself is a disgrace. I'm not criticising Ian King. Ian King seems to be a jovial guy, and he's their business presenter, but it's obviously a hard news item. So what they did was to cover their arses, excuse my language, they gave it a mention, but they didn't follow it day by day, and that's rotten, that.
That's the tactic, Richie. They can always, at the final analysis, the BBC are kings of doing this. They'll say, oh, we did cover it. You know, they covered it for a minute in the midnight news or something, or they buried it away in some part of the website. And like you said, it's like paying lip service, really. Yeah, we covered it and that's it. Over and out, finished. No more updates. And you know, if this was something pro-establishment, if it was what the establishment wanted, this would be rammed down your throat. Like you quite rightly mentioned, the Gina Miller case, that was what the establishment were rooting for. They supported her. And therefore, she became a celebrity, didn't she, effectively? And she still is. And because of that, she's still being dragged up on all sorts of programs to give her opinion even now. But Simon Dolan, nothing in comparison to her.
No. Hey, listen, that was a brilliant piece you wrote for Common Central. It really is. Yeah. It's very good. Can Britain endure 7 more years of the BBC?
I like the word endure very good.
Endure, I know, yeah. But no, listen, I our listeners won't be surprised that I would be in agreement with you about the BBC. There's no point in me trying to make the interview interesting by, you know, shouting you down and putting the other side of it to you. Everybody knows what the BBC has become. But I'd like to talk about you open up talking about its coverage of the Black Lives Matter movement and its coverage of a university professor who said some pretty startling things about people and about white people. And it's a glaring example, really, of what the BBC itself does. Talk to us about that, how it's covered Black Lives Matter.
Well, how's it covered it? I mean, entirely partisan. Not any, as far as I can see. I mean, don't forget, I don't have a television.
You don't watch it.
I'm very proud to say that. I haven't had one for 5 or 6 years now. But you pick up enough being on social media, you get all the clips, all the relevant clips. Same on YouTube, you pick up these things. From what I've seen of the BBC coverage, it was entirely, almost like a campaign group, entirely supportive and not with any kind of scepticism. Although, having said that, I think in the last week there's been a slight shift backwards. Not only the BBC, I think the Premier League and other organisations have sort of started to think, hold on a minute, what are we actually supporting here? What is this organisation? But there's been no scepticism about the Black Lives Matter agenda. There's been no, what I think is the problem is, there's been no investigation or no analysis of what are these people trying to achieve? What are the wider aims? And they've not exactly hidden it. I mean, if you go onto the Black Lives Matter UK website, they're very open about what they want to do to capitalism and the family, single parents and whatnot, and their agenda. It's very, very clear. And you would imagine that actual journalists would have been very interested and said to Black Lives Matter, what's all this about collapsing capitalism? Where does that leave us? Where does it lead us into communism, socialism? What are your wider political aims here? Okay, it's very noble to say that, you know, obviously police injustice, we all agree with that, not just against black people, but against any person, police violence or injustice or intimidation, we're all for that. But journalists have not gone into it at any depth, and I think that's one of the things I've said in from some of my BBC books, is that it's very superficial, the coverage. When they agree, when the BBC and the mainstream media agree with something, the coverage is very superficial. They'll just give you one angle, they won't go into anything else. And yet if they disagree with something, then they will be getting a forensic, you'll get a forensic analysis. So the Black Lives Matter coverage from the BBC, but the BBC narrative is that Britain is racist. End of story. America is racist. Britain is racist. Europe is racist. What are we going to do about it, guys? You know, everybody jump on board. And that's basically summarised their coverage, Richie.
Hey, tell me this. As an intelligent man, as a man who, you know, university lecturer, you're a very, very good writer. I mean, the books are really, really readable. I've got to say that again. When you hear Keir Starmer say things like, and I know you've no time for socialism, I know that. I'm a socialist. I love you anyway, David. And I'll be proven...
We say that every time we talk.
I know. I'll be proven right in the end. Of course I will. Because I know everything. No, seriously. When you hear Keir Starmer say, I'm going to get everybody to do unconscious bias training. What's going on? I mean, look, you've lectured students. You've met young people. I find that... And I don't do melodrama. I really don't. I find that fairly terrifying now.
Well, I do. What is it?
Yeah. I mean,
psychologists do talk about unconscious bias. So I think it does exist. But I mean, Keir Starmer, the way that he said, okay, I think it was a caller to a radio show that he was on who basically put him on the spot and said, what are you going to do? And he said, oh, well, I'll do unconscious bias training. That sounds, to me, it sounds like something Orwellian. It's going to be, what, two or three hours sitting, listening to someone, you know, with a flip chart and some coloured pens and sitting around in little groups all confessing your sins, your unconscious bias. It's Orwellian. It's almost creating bogeymen that don't exist. It's scaring people as well, because what it's saying is, listen, you might think you're a nice kind of, you know, good-natured person and you're not very nasty, but guess what? We've got news.
You're not.
You really are. You are, actually. You're just hiding. Yeah, yeah. You're just pretending. How can you win, Richie, with that?
The
reason they do that, Richie, is to batter down resistance. When they've lost an argument and you say, well, look, we're quite happy. We welcome people. British people have been welcoming people actually for hundreds of years, actually. They're not a racist nation, apart from very, you know, very tiny, tiny minority. I'm sorry, that's not good enough. We're going to prove that actually you are. Whatever you say, we've got something to counter that. Whatever evidence, you know, your evidence of providing shelter for refugees over 100 years from many, many different kinds of regimes and desperate people, yeah. But, sorry, that's not good enough. We're still going to prove that you are terrible, horrible, awful people. You just don't know it. I mean, where does that end?
Yeah, it ends badly is where it ends. I mean, for me, I have read papers on unconscious bias, and some of the arguments are persuasive. But when it comes to race, I liked something that Zuby said when he was on, the rapper and the entrepreneur. Zuby said, well, I see it more as tribalism. You know, we must be somehow deep, deep down in our DNA, we must be more inclined towards people who look and sound like us. And and that's not bias. That's maybe that's tribalism. I don't know. But this is dangerous. By the way, you might not have heard this, but Starmer has been embarrassed this afternoon because
again
because the Times found out that the 3 hours that he said to Sharon on LBC, in fact, the course is going to be 20 minutes long, a 20 minute long on unconscious bias. And presumably everybody will walk out of the room a much better person at the end of it. Wow.
I think that's probably because they haven't got enough material to stretch it for longer than 20 minutes.
This is it.
What you were saying about Zuby there, Richard, that's right. That, I mean, sometimes I think to myself, racism is a term that people use a lot, and people have a very, I don't know, a meme. It's almost a meme, and sometimes I wonder, what is actual racism? I mean, Zuby's point there, tribalism is completely different. Tribalism, when people feel safe and protected by people who are similar to them, and that's an anthropological reality throughout history. And the reason why people group together in tribes all the way through history is because there is a potential threat from outsiders, and people tend to do that. When I was lecturing a couple of years ago, I noticed I did a class once, and it was in Cambridge. I've worked in Cambridge, and you know, the article I wrote there was mentioning Cambridge. And I have experience of teaching and lecturing to international students from all over the world. And there was once, and I was very interested to see the interactions going on in this class. I had walked into a class one day, and on the left-hand side of the room, I had about 8 or 9 Japanese students. On the right-hand side, I had about 12 Italians. Don't ask me how that happened, but I was just asked to cover this class once. I walked in, and someone said, quick, get upstairs, we need someone to cover. So I did. And it was interesting to notice that the Japanese students, the cultural behavior, you know, I had the Italians yawning and sort of shouting and doing all sorts of weird stuff. And the Japanese were very, very sort of silent and sitting there just watching me, very polite and respectful. But what I noticed was when we had our breaks, that the Japanese students congregated together with the Japanese students, and the Italian students congregated together in little groups, you know, went downstairs to a coffee place. And I thought, this is interesting, because this is just tribal behavior. It's because we feel comfortable with people who share what we consider the same characteristics and, you know, behaviors, etc. And I thought, that's not racism. That's not racism. That's just people who feel comfortable. There was nothing untoward between those two groups. They accepted each other and got on with what they were doing. Now, race baiters and race hustlers would enter this scenario right now in 2020. Say, oh my God, look at that. This is racist. Look at those Italians. They're being racist. Look at those Japanese people. They're acting. Look at the prejudices at play. They would analyze it. They would overanalyze it. Whereas I think what Zuby's saying and what I would say is, no, they are people who are behaving in tribal ways because that's what's comfortable to them. Don't go in there and try and mix it up. Don't say, look, we're going to force you together. You know, a government would come in there now, Keir Starmer, for example, would come in and say, right, we're going to legislate. We're going to make Italian and Japanese students force them to sit together at break times. That's what we're going to do, and that's our progressive, better society. I don't know whether that would be a better society, but I think that's very heavy-handed. And I just think we need to think about that word racism again. It's just used all the time. And I don't think 99.9% of the people who use it actually have an idea what it is.
No, and before I put a but to that, because there's something I want you to consider. I want to remind our listeners, David Sedgwick's latest book, The Fake News Factory, Tales from BBC Land. You can get that online. And it's great value. You can get the paperback for about £8. And at the moment, you can get the Kindle version of it for £4 for £3.99. Do yourself a favour and educate yourself.
And
buy the book. It is a bargain. It is a bargain. I've got a copy of it here. You were kind enough to send it to me. Look, black people do have genuine grievances. I think the Bianca Williams, and you know I'm not a virtue signaler, David, you know that. I think the Bianca Williams, Ricardo Dos Santos thing, that's creepy, that. The police seemingly have lied about the reasons for pulling them over. They said they were driving erratically. But when they gave their own report to the couple, there was no mention of the driving. And now Cressida Dick has had to do an about turn and apologise. And the chap very articulate chap, very successful athlete, the 400-metre record holder in Portugal. He says, he's not too angry, he's not shouting about it. He said, look, got a nice car, they keep stopping me. There's no excuse for that, David. There isn't. I don't care if the guy in the car is an axe murderer. Unless you know he's an axe murderer, you can't be pulling him over because of the colour of his skin. And that seems to be a real thing in 2020. What do you think?
Well, I agree. Well, I absolutely agree on that principle. I don't think anyone should face any kind of intimidation because of who they are. Absolutely not. That case you're talking about, that Bianca Williams and I think Ricardo Santos. Yeah, I know that the police have reviewed the case, and apparently, according to them, the officers did not act out of what would be expected in that situation, apparently. But you're right that it's a bit odd that they said that the occupants of the car were driving erratically and down
the wrong side of the street. Yeah.
We don't, I mean, I have to say, we don't know whether that, I hope that will come out at a later point, I hope.
Well, it wasn't in their own report, you see. The couple said, give us a copy of the report, and they did, and there was no mention of it. And that stinks, that, you know.
That's what the crux of this matter is, Richie. Either if they can't prove that the car was behaving in that manner that they described, if it ultimately transpires that that was wrong and they've invented that or made that, that's serious, and I would absolutely say that there's a case to be answered. I'm going to hold fire on that one. If it does turn out that there was some reason that they pulled up that car in that particular area of London, they said they were patrolling and it's a high crime area, etc., then I get my support. At the moment, I've got an open mind on that. I think we're going to have to wait and see what transpires there. But I agree with you. Yeah, I mean, I'd be absolutely outraged if I was being stopped by the police. And also that the way they did it. Yeah, I think Keir Starmer was right on that one. I think I would be a little bit uncomfortable. But then the situation escalated very, very quickly, didn't it? You know, people start shouting and screaming, and there's a child involved. Half a dozen of one. You know, I don't know what I would have done in that situation. I think the police were a little, I thought they were a little bit, perhaps a little bit over the top there, but I'm not sure the response they were getting back. I mean, I've been stopped by the police. I don't know if you have. I've been stopped. I don't get stopped all the time. It's only happened to me once or twice. Yeah. I got stopped once driving around Bootle when my car tax had expired 2 days before. I didn't realise it, and the police stopped me. They had one of those those automatic gun things, and they flagged me down, and I just sat there, and you know, I didn't resist, I didn't shout or scream.
But I tell you what, David, Well, Ricardo might have shouted and screamed because this was the 17th time it happened to him. I'll tell you what's not going to happen to you, and it's not going to happen to me. I used to drive a Mercedes S500. Don't get excited, listeners. I couldn't afford a Mercedes S500 if I lived to be 200 years old. I bought a 20-year-old model some years ago for £1,500. And I loved it. And it was a beautiful looking car. Nobody's going to stop me in that car. Nobody's going to stop you in that car. But a black lad is getting stopped in that car. I know, crazy lefty who's looking to be, to be the nice guy speaking up for black people. But I think there is a, I think the police, when I interviewed that gentleman a few weeks back, who didn't want to speak to me after the interview, even though I treated him very well. I accepted his contention that there was systemic racism in some quarters of the police, and that's all I would say. Pulling the guy over because he's driving a Mercedes, something is wrong with that. But let me just bring it slightly forward, because you make a brilliant point in your article, which people can read if they go to commentcentral.co.uk. I will tweet a link to it now. David Sedgwick is our guest, and it's startling to see the BBC jump on the Black Lives Matter thing and accept that everybody's racist and everything is racist. Okay, if they want to do that. But then a Cambridge lecturer says some outlandish stuff, let's be honest about it, and not a peep. Not a
ignored.
Peep.
Ignored. Completely ignored. And what she said was pretty awful. What did she say? Abolish whiteness.
Yeah.
That's what, I don't know how you do that unless you're thinking of genocidal terms. I don't know how you abolish an entire race. I don't think you can do it by legislation, but so I don't know what she meant by that. And then also really quite a disturbing one was she tweeted, a year before that, she tweeted, just to paraphrase, something like, I resist the temptation to kneecap white males.
Yeah.
Well, there's lots of them walking around Cambridge. I've worked in Cambridge on many occasions, Richie, and I can assure you, I'd have to worry about my safety if I'm walking around.
Well, I hope she gives us a heads up, David. If she ever loses the ability to resist knee cap and white men, I hope she'll at least tweet, "Listen, I can no longer hold myself back," so that we can go on the run. That's mad stuff, isn't it? From a Cambridge, this is a woman called Gopal.
Priyamvada Gopal. But she then took to Twitter to say that, and this is what really worries me, the wider context, she took to social media then to boast that people like me were expecting that she might get at least suspended or something, I suppose, naively assuming that's a pretty gross, offensive thing to throw out there for a Cambridge lecture, for anybody, let alone a Cambridge lecture. But she boasted on Twitter that she'd been promoted, that she'd got some promotion in the light of that. That was Cambridge University showing how woke they were and showing they were supporting what she said. This British educational institution was actually supporting her anti-white racism.
Yeah. You make me laugh, though. Speaking to you makes me laugh. Every time I speak to you, I make my laugh. You make me laugh. Do you know why? Not because you are saying anything that's hysterical or unimportant. What you're saying is important. But I think of you as a university lecturer, and we live in an era where if you're studying criminology at UCD in Dublin or at Cambridge in London, you will get trigger warnings before they show crime scene photographs in the classroom. Jesus Christ, David, what's going on? It's true, isn't it? Hey, listen.
Richie, that lady, Gopal, as I think I'm noting that article, the BBC know about her. Because she's kind of, in my opinion, she's trying to sort of supplant Yasmin Alibi Brown and Ash Sarkar as being the professional anti-white media talking head. Because back in 2018, she'd accused Cambridge porters of discriminating against international students. Apparently they were locking students out who were late for lectures based on skin colour.
Right.
And of course the BBC picked that up. I mean, they were very happy to run with that. And they wrote an extremely sympathetic article about Gopal's complaint to the Cambridge University. And they launched Cambridge University launched an investigation based on that. And the BBC were all over it. Well, as someone who's worked in Cambridge many summers, I've managed international summer schools there, and I know those porters very, very well, and they are true gentlemen, you know. And she was accusing Cambridge porters of being racist, effectively, and I know that for a fact is wrong, and I know that's a falsehood, because I've been there in the middle of the night when students have arrived in taxis from Gatwick and Heathrow, and the porters have made them incredibly welcome, offered them a drink, taken their bags up to their rooms, been very, very friendly and chatty, very, very helpful. I know those guys. And they're great guys and they're gentlemen. So I knew that was a falsehood, but the BBC were all over that. And yet this one, when she was talking about abolishing whiteness, not a peep on it.
When I read your...
That tells you something's wrong, Rich.
Of course, it's terribly wrong. I read your book, BBC Brainwashing Britain, which I think came out in 2018, I think.
Yeah.
It's the first time we spoke around about that time. And I didn't realise how bad... The BBC my listeners are going to say, you're really naive. I'm not. I knew things are very, very bad. But I read David's book. And then shortly after that, and I'm not making this about me now, I'm not. But producers from the BBC wanted me to take part in an anti-Semitism documentary. And it was with David Baddiel. And a woman kept ringing me up called Lucy. And I said, listen, no problems. I'm happy to participate. And my only thing is, I want to bring a camera with me and so that we can film the entire thing. Not to broadcast it, I will sign a release form that I will never publish mine until it's actually gone out on BBC Two. Oh, why do you want to do that? Well, I said, just to protect myself, it's pretty standard these days. They kept coming back to me and said, no, we're not going to allow you to bring a camera. And in the meantime, a very good friend of mine, who is working at the BBC to this day, rang me up and said, Richie, they're trying to stitch you up. They're going to, in the edit, they're going to make you look like some, because I do have a shaven head, because I'm going bald. They're going to make you look like some skin-headed romper stomper guy who hates Jews. And he said, I'm ashamed to say this, but that's what they're going to do. They don't want to hear you say that you have no time for Israel or what it does, and that you don't really care too much about Jews, and that your accountant is Jewish, and one of your, you know, really close mates is Jewish. And I thought, how rotten and how wretched. But that's what they are.
That's where they stooped. Those gotchas. This is gotcha journalism. That's all they do these days. It's to get a few thousand likes on social media and say, hey, look, we got him.
Dreadful.
And you're right. They would have portrayed you very, very negatively. I remember when Victoria Derbyshire got Carl Benjamin, Sargon of Akkad, into the studio, and he thought he was, it was something he'd written about Jess Phillips, that Labour MP. He'd made some very, very poor taste joke saying, "I wouldn't rape her." I
think that's what
he said. It was pretty poor taste. And he thought he was genuinely coming in to talk about, you know, the nuances behind that statement.
Yeah.
And she just proceeded to read over him. They'd got lots of statements from, you know, anti-rape groups and women's groups and refuges. And she just read them over him in a loud voice. He just sat there in the chair. And he was absolutely, you could see he was startled. He thought he was going to, they were going to give him an opportunity to explain the context. I mean, even though it was a poor joke, but he'd done it in a certain ironic context, okay? And they just weren't going to allow him to do that. And she just read it over him in the loudest voice she possibly could.
And you know what? That's not the way Victoria Derbyshire used to be, because I remember listening to her on Radio 5 Live years ago. And I wonder what has happened in, not just to her, but in the meantime, is pressure being brought to bear by editors on presenters to behave like this?
And Emily Maitlis is one of the worst. And I wrote a little bit about her a few weeks ago when she did that anti-Dominic Cummings rant. In that book I recently wrote, I'm focusing quite a lot on organisational culture, because I think it's the culture that needs fixing there. And in all mainstream media outlets, there's a kind of, you know, something rotten in the state of BBC and MSM generally. So, and it starts at the top. You know, they say the fish rots from the head down. And at the moment, you've got a BBC management, Tony Hall and the BBC Board of Governors. He's going soon. So I don't know whether Tim Davey, the new Director General, will be able to reset that ship. I don't think so. I don't know how one man can affect the culture that much. But you're right. There's a pressure on those. When you enter the BBC, there's a pressure, a downwards pressure. You enter that organisation, and this is how we do things. You know, we set people up for gotchas. Yeah. We've got a list here. It's not an actual list, a physical list of wrong thinkers and bad people. I think I say that in that first book.
It's a very
polarised black and white world, Rich.
And isn't it funny that they got stitched up by Tommy Robinson, which I found that profoundly ironic. Fantastic. I mean,
the ultimate sort of it was the ultimate irony that he set. They thought they were setting him up.
And
sounds like a Len Dayton novel, but he was actually setting him up. John Sweeney then, and of course John Sweeney has subsequently been relieved of his duties, let's say. And he now rants on YouTube to about 1,000 followers. So he's fallen.
Oh, what an embarrassment that was for the BBC, because they would revile Tommy Robinson. Now, I've interviewed Tommy Robinson, not recently, over the years. I don't like him. I think he's violent. I don't have any time for violence at all. But he's a human being, and I wouldn't delete him from Facebook, and I wouldn't delete him from PayPal. In fact, I supported his right to be allowed on Facebook. But it was funny that he stitched him up. Now, that brings us to cancel culture. Wow, this is flying by. David Sedgwick is our guest. We've got David for another 20 minutes. Let's talk cancel culture, because in your article you talk about the historian David Starkey. Now, I don't care what anybody thinks of David Starkey. I, as somebody who studied history myself, I find him a bit of a pain in the arse. However, we have entered a paradigm today in 2020 where a man or a woman can have their career destroyed, ripped to pieces, thrown into a wheelie bin. Because they've said something that somebody else takes offence to.
Yeah.
Wow.
Shocking. Absolutely shocking. And in fact, before I mention him, I think J.K. Rowling has been another that's been on the end of a backlash. And I think she's just signed a letter with intellectual colossuses like Noam Chomsky and Salman Rushdie. And they've said, we've got to end this. We've got to end this. Because where does our society go to when you can't brook anyone else's opinion without wanting to destroy them? I mean, next they'll be wanting to exterminate you. This is going to, you know, Stalin back in the 1930s, how did he used to get rid of his opponents? He used to accuse them of a crime that they didn't even know they'd committed and then pronounce them guilty. There was no defense and you disappeared off to the gulag. That's where this ultimately ends up. So I was glad to see that. It's ironic, of course, that J.K. Rowling is writing this, because she was a little bit of a... she was one of the sort of main leaders for shutting people down quite not so long ago.
But she was.
Kind of like, it's come full circle a little bit. I'm waiting for the day it happens to Owen Jones. I think there's a lot of us waiting for the day it finally catches up with Owen Jones. Another guy, of course, who was the Father Ted writer.
Graham Linehan,
Graham Linehan, he was responsible for getting, I think, the man called Count Dankula. He took a lot of heat when his pug dog did a Nazi salute, allegedly. And Graham Linehan was lining up to cancel him. Well, Graham Linehan has found himself on the end of that now. So, you know, some people are smirking and saying, you know, what goes round comes round. But I'm still waiting for Owen Jones to go down myself. But I think there'll be a mass celebration when it finally catches up with Owen Jones. But, yeah, David Starkey. He's actually lost his livelihood. He's been Fitzwilliam College. They've got rid of him. I think he resigned under massive pressure. But this pressure is media generated and social media generated. 90% of the people don't give a damn whether David Starkey is working at Fitzwilliam, and they're not calling for his head. That's another issue we have in this day and age, Richie, where social media can actually get rid of someone, can actually ruin your career, and yet it's only
a minority of
a pretty small minority of people. And also, I think another college in Kent cancelled him because he said damned blacks. Well, you've got Gopal, Priyavimba Gopal, saying, I'd like to kneecap white males. Pretty horrible. She's got her job. She's been promoted. David Starkey says damn blacks. And he's lost his livelihood, and he's arguably one of the world's leading historians.
Yeah, he said slavery wasn't genocide because, you know, blacks are around and more or less. And he's since said it was clumsy. I believe that everybody has a right to be wrong. Now, I'm not saying whether David Starkey is right or wrong. I'm not scared of saying whether I agree with him or disagree with him. That's for the listener to decide. But for a tiny minority of people to pile on him on social media, and for that then to result in him being destroyed in the way that he has, and for everybody else to say, okay, that's it, and rub their hands of it. Do people not realise what that might mean for them in the near future?
Well, no, because, you know, people like J.K. Rowling and Graham Linehan, they didn't realise.
No.
It's only when it comes home to you that you suddenly realise how wrong you've been. I mean, yeah, you're right. Some people would definitely not agree with his assessment. He's a historian. I'm prepared to trust his judgment on certain things. I don't know whether he was right or wrong about what he was talking about genocide. I mean, it depends on your definition of genocide and et cetera, and your understanding of that historical process. But he's allowed that opinion. He can articulate that opinion. Surely we should be in a place where a historian can articulate an opinion, even if a minority on Twitter don't agree with it. But the consequences of that, you can see the consequence where that leads society is that people are not going to say, they're not going to speak. I mean, I already think people are not talking. People are keeping opinions to themselves.
Yeah.
They're terrified. This is real. This is Stalinism.
Do you remember years ago, David, do you remember a time, because I remember, when David Starkey would have been invited onto a television programme where there would have been time allocated to the discussion of what he had said, and they would have gotten one or two other doyens of history, you know, from various academic institutions who disagreed with him, and he would have bashed it out. Maybe Robin Day might have sat in the middle. That was great, but not anymore.
Not anymore. I mean, and also don't forget that, the reason that I think David Starkey's been marginalised anyway over the years, because like I said, he's on that list of sort of suspect bad people, a sort of old white male with outdated, unfashionable opinions. So he's ripe. Don't forget, you know, I think people who make statements such as Gopal, who we've been talking about there, that they can say whatever they like. That's the other thing as well, the sheer hypocrisy, Richie. Okay, if you're going to sack, if you're going to destroy David Starkey, then destroy Gopal too. Let's have a level playing field. Either both of them keep their jobs, you promote them both. Promote Gopal. I don't know how you could promote David Starkey. He's quite obnoxious, David, I have to admit.
He's a bit of a pain in the arse. Yeah.
My main objection to him is he just doesn't shut up, and you can never have a conversation with him. He's such a colossus of knowledge and self-satisfied smugness. But nevertheless, if you're going to promote Gopal and you're going to let her talk about what she was talking about there was effectively genociding an entire race. He's saying he was questioning whether you could call the history of slavery an actual genocide. I think it was clumsy the way he expressed that. But okay, but if you're going to promote her, promote him. If you're going to sack him, sack her. Let's just have a level playing field. You know, we live in very dishonest times, Richie, where people are using double standards and they're trying to justify those double standards to themselves. I mean, Cambridge University, you know, after Gopal had tweeted those extremely obnoxious horrifying remarks. I mean, just imagine if you're a white male from Northern Ireland walking around Cambridge and you're thinking, hold on, this woman's talking about kneecapping.
Yeah.
Just imagine how offensive that would be to anybody, but especially certain people who perhaps got a little bit more immediate experience of that kind of talk, you know, what was meted out in the Troubles. It was a very, very common sort of thing. I think that would be hugely offensive. But no one's calling for her head at all.
And I don't think they should. I agree with you. I mean,
and I agree they shouldn't.
No.
But they shouldn't do Starkey then in that case, should they?
We should be allowed to use terms irrespective of whether it might wind somebody up. I've had this out with a couple of people recently about comparing what some IDF soldiers do to Palestinians with how Jews were treated in concentration camps. And I don't make that comparison very often. In fact, I don't. I don't go out of my way to make it. But when I see people saying on Twitter that it's outrageous, I sometimes jump in and say, well, it's not outrageous. You know, doing certain things to people, it can be compared to what happened. And, you know, people shouldn't be precluded or they shouldn't censor themselves from saying that. And you should take... I don't mean that you should take the career consequences. You shouldn't be fired for that. But if somebody wants to debate you, you should front up and you should debate, you know. And I would say to Gopal, I wouldn't want her fired for that. What would have happened years ago is somebody very senior in the university might have said to Gopal, hey, listen, madam, you know, you're representing one of the world's most famous institutions here. Behave yourself. That's what would have happened. And nobody would have been fired, but not today. But, you know, before you come back in, Stuart Waiton has done some amazing work on this, the academic in Abertay University in Scotland, but he's a Geordie. He's done amazing work on this about creating vulnerable groups. You know, you can't, we're tiptoeing around the world now, or we're supposed to, taking great care not to offend an alleged vulnerable group. Now, I know that some guy who was kneecapped in Northern Ireland had horrendous experiences, but somebody shouldn't be turfed out of a job because they used the term kneecapping, even if it was in a joke. But anyway, it's just mad stuff, this. I'm so glad I'm independent. I really am.
Well, so am I. I think a lot of I'm very glad that there's people like you around, Rich. I was just going to say that when Gopal made those remarks, Cambridge jumped to her defence and they said, and this makes it even worse, they said, look, our academics are able to express themselves and that's what we give them that freedom.
But not Starkey.
Problematical you may find it. But then 1 week later they sack Starkey. I mean, that's what worries me. We live in such a dishonest era. Rich, I think I said that in one of the books I read. I think we're in an unprecedented era of dishonesty, and we shouldn't be, because this is post-enlightenment, for God's sake. I mean, we're supposed to have moved on. We've got social science, we've got psychology, we've got these things. We're supposed to be evolving as a race. The human race is supposed to be evolving. Our sensibilities are supposed to be improving. But I can only see us going backwards. We're going back almost to the medieval age. But they have an excuse. You know, there was kind of certain level amount of ignorance in the Middle Ages that 500 years later we shouldn't have. But we're going backwards and not forwards, and that really worries me. And there's no excuse why we should be intellectually dishonest. You know, you've got things like the Lancet medical journal publishing that nonsense about hydroxychloroquine purely because it doesn't fit the New World Order agenda of vaccine. And then they had to retract it because it was full of lies. And they realized they'd published, and they did it purely because it's part of the establishment agenda, the New World Order, the vaccine, and the anti-Trump, because Trump had said, oh, yeah, I'm taking hydroxychloroquine. Oh, great, we've got some spurious academics here saying they've done a study across cultural study here of 95,000 people that say it's actually dangerous. And it's been debunked. But the Lancet were quite happy to publish that purely on political grounds. And that's where we are, Rich. We're in a hugely dishonest age. And I think looking back on this, if we ever get through it, historians are going to look back on the 21st century, the first decades of the 21st century, and this was an unprecedented age of self-deception and deceit.
Now, David Sedgwick is our guest. While I'm listening to that intensely, and I'm talking off mic because I want to play you a little clip, and I'm going to do it if I can. I'm going to play you a clip. I don't know if you heard it. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll play it in a second, because there's a lot of tweets as well coming in on this. This is hugely interesting, this. Hugely interesting. Hey, you will be aware, won't you, that speaking of J.K. Rowling, she's one of a large number of people who've written a letter about cancel culture. Yeah. Do you welcome that? Do you think they mean it? Because I, again, as somebody who criticises Israel all the time, and I know it pisses people off, but fair enough, I am who I am. I'm an open book. I'm very honest. I'm not hiding anything. I believe that everything is, when they talk about cancel culture and people should be allowed to say what they want, I think if you put it to some of these people, they might kind of omit, you know, criticism of Israel, but that's just me. Do you welcome this letter that they've written, and what do you think of it?
Well, I think I'm 100% free speech. I'm sorry. I think that if you offend people, well, you have to take that risk, because otherwise you close down important possible debates. You narrow the debate and you don't expand it. We need to be expanding it, even if people have different sensibilities. You know, it takes a lot to offend me, but people are more fragile. We have different people who are fragile. We can't sort of cotton wool society and debate because some people may be a little more fragile than other people. We have to, unfortunately, you're going to have to put up with it. Life is not easy, and we have to take difficult topics and we have to discuss them. So, I was glad to see that, but I'm not 100% sure about the people behind it. For example, Salman Rushdie was cancelled almost literally by the Islamic scholar, some Islamic clerics, of course, back in the 80s. He's got first-hand knowledge of what life can be like once you become a pariah. And a threat to his life was very... I think it's that fatwa is still in... allegedly, it's still in operation. So he knows what can happen. Well, if you write something that offends someone and someone takes it to the extreme point, you could be under threat to... Your life could be under threat, like his was. So I really hope that they mean it. But it takes a lot that it's actually when J.K. Rowling is personally under threat herself, that then she suddenly wakes up. And I think that's the problem, Richie. I think there's a lot of people out there slinging mud at other people who will only wake up if it actually turns on them.
Well, that's
right.
It's a shame
that happens, because I'm watching it thinking it could turn on me one day. It hasn't. But I don't want anyone to be in that situation. So it's not just me personally. Someone might come after me and say, oh, you've written a comment in your book, Brainwashing Britain. Right, we're cancelling you. Although I've got nothing to cancel, Rich. I've got nothing to lose, so I'm okay on that one. But I just wish some of these people to step forward before, and it's not just because it's personally threatening them now. You know, the worm has turned against them, but I wish they'd have just done it on behalf of humanity.
Yeah, beforehand.
Rather than personal interest.
But at least they're doing it now. I want to play you 90 seconds of James O'Brien's radio program on LBC Radio yesterday.
Please,
right?
You're going to inflict that on
me. I know, I am. I am going to inflict it on you, because it speaks to your article in which we've been referring to today, which I will tweet a link
to.
Yeah, it's 90 seconds. And remember, for my audience again, and I don't know if you know this yourself, David, but I have worked at pretty much every level of the media, you know, from making tea to producing to doing the graveyard shift to presenting prime time to presenting very, very big talk shows with huge audiences. I've been lucky enough to have a go at all of it. Never thought I'd ever hear anything like this on the radio. You listen to this, here we go.
Right.
James O'Brien from yesterday.
Reports today show that nearly one in six Britons say they will refuse a coronavirus vaccine if it becomes available. And another similar number is still unsure about it. Now, I told you at the time, and I want to make this clear, I told you at the time that the strangest thing in the early days of this crisis for me were the messages I was getting from old mates, like people coming to me via Facebook who I haven't seen for 30 years, lads I was at school with who know that I'm in the media. So they thought, rightly or wrongly, that I might be able to give them a steer on stuff. Or a mate of mine who's a barber who got in touch to say, I've been sent this thing on WhatsApp. Is it true about the 5G masts? So when I say I don't want to talk to you if you are in this category of people, then I don't want you to think that I'm sort of looking down on you. I just can't obviously use this platform to promote opinions or ideas that will kill other people listening. That's just my responsibility to you. That's human to human, parent to parent, if you like. I can't do that. But I do care passionately about you and your safety and your family's health. And the fact that you have become an anti-vaxxer is terrifying and tragic. And I want to help you come out of that darkness. But I, if I let you talk to me about it, then you might bend some ears of people listening. And that would be like conducting a proper debate about whether or not bleach cures coronavirus or the moon is made of cheese. I can't do that because someone might go away and drink bleach, you see. Even if you came on the radio and struggled to make valid rhetorical points against me, some people listening might still fall for it. The problem with...
Yeah. I mean, I've never heard anything like that in all my years listening to the radio. Yeah. Basically, I'm not going to allow you on, even though I could beat you. I could beat you because I'm James O'Brien. I'm not going to let you on because you could kill somebody.
Yes, yeah. It's quite... Yeah, he raised the stakes there a little bit. He's justifying his own cowardice there, isn't he? Look, I'm not going to debate anyone who might be able to give me some facts, some alternative information about a very hugely important issue. So I'll just pretend that it's a matter of life and death. And also, I also really enjoyed the fact that he's got mates from 30 years ago getting in touch with him, seeking his wisdom.
That smelled a bit.
Some kind of guru, some scientific guru. I 30 years, what, they suddenly got in touch with him? What a load of bull.
What a load of nonsense.
He's a complete jerk. He's a complete establishment shill, isn't he? I mean...
And imagine he wasn't good enough for the BBC. He did Newsnight a couple of times and he was so bad they got rid of him. I mean, he is horrendously bad.
Well, actually, what's quite funny about him was he actually... He did a couple of stints for Newsnight, didn't he? And what made me laugh was that he was quite open. He said, I'm an anti-Brexit, anti-Trump. And the BBC panicked and went, oh my God, he's told the truth. We'd better get rid of him. We don't want you... Yeah. You're supposed to lie, James. You're supposed to say, no, I'm impartial. Off you go. We can't have you. You're too truthful.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was extraordinary, wasn't it?
Extraordinary. And look, I'm neither a vaxxer nor am I an anti-vaxxer. I know that one particular vaccine, Gardasil, has done terrible damage to girls in my country. Therefore, there is an issue with vaccine safety. And anybody could find that out. But if that's going to be the world, right, okay, from now on in, on this particular program, nothing like that will ever be discussed again. Yeah. It's shocking.
And you know what he's doing there, Richie? Polarisation. This is the Marxist poll. They do it with every conceivable topic.
It's binary choice, isn't it? Binary choice tactic. Yeah.
You're either with us or against us. There's no nuance in the middle here because they don't want to go into nuance. It's either you agree with us or we cast you out. You agree with us or we send you to the gulag because they can't take anything in the middle. They can't take all those nuances. Yeah, you're quite right. Some vaccines seem to be successful. Others have issues surrounding them. That's the grey area. He doesn't want to discuss that. He just wants to say you're a good person or you're a bad person. Yeah, you're good or evil. This is the polarisation they work with. And he's a mainstream media hack. And that's what they use all the time. And they're going to demonise you. And if you dare say, yeah, OK, some vaccines are OK. They seem OK. I'm not happy with this one. Heretic. Cast it out.
Danger to society. Hey, listen, do me a favour. In the very early autumn, come back. Because you can talk about anything and you're great value. I love having you on. I want to say again, folks, David has written sports books as well, but on the BBC, the Fake News Factory, which is very, very new, and you can get it for £3.99 for your tablet if you have a tablet, and it's only £8 the paperback, and it's a terrific read, as is BBC Brainwashing Britain. Thanks for that. The article that we were referring to earlier on is on commentcentral.co.uk. I will tweet a link out to it immediately upon ending the programme. Thanks for your time, mate. Your time is valuable and you've shared it with us today, and I've loved listening to you. I really appreciate it.
Great. It's nice talking to you again, Richie. Great.
Anytime. And I look forward to speaking again in the early autumn. Cheers, David. David Sedgwick, top man. Thanks to him again for coming on today. That is pretty much it for the programme. Max Egan's YouTube channel was deleted. That's a disgrace. I don't know what else to say about that. 230,000 subscribers there. People coming to get a different take on what's going on in the world off Max. Thousands of videos. I believe that the videos were backed up. Thank heavens for that. And Max Egan is going to be doing his work on BitChute now. BitChute, yeah, that's how you pronounce it. It's rotten, but that's where we are. The Richie Allen YouTube will be deleted again very soon. I know this because they've deleted one or two of my videos. And they're warning me. That's fine. I can't wait for it. Because I hate the fucking thing. I hate it. And I don't want to be uploading there every day. I do it out of habit. Because some of you seem to spend your lives on YouTube. But when they delete the Richie Allen YouTube channel, I won't even complain about it. I won't even say a word on Twitter. I'll be delighted. Because I fucking hate them. I hate them and I hate Google. I hate what they've done to humanity and what they are doing. This programme will always be available on podomatic.com and it will always be live between 5 o'clock and 7 o'clock on a Monday to Thursday and 11 o'clock on a Sunday. And I'm not going anywhere. I'm getting emails from people who are a bit worried. This programme is not going anywhere in the short term. I can't live without this programme. I can't live without getting the chance to talk about these things and spend 2 hours in your company. And I'm not just saying that. I love spending 2 hours with you every day, as mad as it is sometimes to do the programme. So don't be worried about that. I'm not going anywhere, right? Look after yourselves. Back tomorrow, Thursday, at 5 o'clock UK time with your Richie Allen Show. Bye now. Here's James Taylor.